The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
I want to announce the release of our Partially Examined Life 2017 wall calendar featuring the art of Corey Moher, the mind behind the very popular Existential Comics. Check out existentialcomics.com. So it's got great philosopher pictures, quotes, information about the figures, philosopher birthdays, holidays real and otherwise. You can order it right now at partiallyexaminedlife.com/calendar.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute. If you're looking for a place where the classroom work is carried out in a similar spirit to what we do here at PEL, you might want to consider St. John's College. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
You are listening to the Partially Examined Life. This is part two of episode 153 on Richard Rorty's Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, part one, Our Glassy Essence, Our Gassy Essence, published in 1979. In part one, we talked about what the point of this is and got into discussions of personhood and the fact that Rorty thinks that we mix up perennial notions about human dignity with specifically philosophical notions that were born in the 17th century with Descartes and Kant and other folks like that about the mind. So we're going to finally drill back to the beginning of chapter one here and go through a little more slowly through the text to get at more of his arguments.
Let's talk about the mental. So ultimately, we need to know what we mean by the mental. And it seems obvious at a surface level, but I think he's going to try to show us once we start investigating it, it's not as clear as we think. And so he starts out with a kind of basic intuition about what is mental involving this criterion of non-spatiality. It's just what's not physical. And then persistence, as in being able to exist even when the body is destroyed. And the problem here is he's thinking specifically about neo-dualists who have rejected substance dualism or Cartesian dualism, where the mind is just this separate substance. There's matter and then there's mind. There's this mind stuff, which is another basic category of existence. But they want to preserve some kind of dualism. And one strategy is to say that the mental is just two different descriptions of the same thing, for instance.
Yeah, he talked about, it always seems to us when we're doing these things, when we're reading things relevant to this, that, you know, of course, there's not like ghost substance wandering around. That can't be right, like Descartes thought, or like traditional religion might think that this spirit stuff somehow gets in our bodies. That seems weird. So what are the alternatives, though, to talking about this? It could be that, well, when I talk about my feelings and my brain, I'm really just using two different words for the same thing. Or another way, the Spinoza way, is to say, well, whenever we're talking about the physical and the mental, we're just talking about two different aspects of the same thing. So it's either two descriptions, take the linguistic term, or two different aspects, take a straightforwardly metaphysical turn, two different kinds of properties of the same underlying stuff. And he thinks both of those are problematic.
Well, they're problematic in the sense that they sort of presuppose the ontological gap. They treat it as a presupposition, in a sense, he thinks. So he tells us that dualists either must justify that assumption of the ontological gap, or they must give us a version of dualism that doesn't rely on it. Because he doesn't think that talking about alternative descriptions or properties of the same thing, he doesn't think that really gets rid of the ontological gap. That's just another way of saying there is an ontological gap.
And this whole first section, laying out that problem, is in preface to saying, well, in order to understand this, we need to talk about what is the mental. What on earth do we mean by that? In the end, to try to convince us that there's no ontological gap to be considered, I guess, or to put it aside.
And I honestly don't know how he doesn't really explain why this sort of strategy that they use of two descriptions of the same thing is another version of the ontological gap. If we think he's right about that, the next step in his argument is to look at other examples of ontological gaps. So the finite and the infinite, human and the divine, particular and the universal.
Well, he wants to try to identify what an ontological gap is. And those are the only ones that he immediately can point to.
Is that it? Is it because he wants to say what an ontological gap is? Is that the reason why he makes that move?
I think so. So on page 19, he summarizes the dilemma. Either neo-dualists must construct an epistemological account of how we know a priori that entities fall under two irreducibly distinct ontological species, or they must find some way of expressing their dualism, which relies on neither the notion of ontological gap nor that of alternative description. But before casting about for ways to resolve the dilemma, we should look more closely at the notion of ontological species or ontological gap. And then he just asks a bunch of questions about what it is. He says, so we know perhaps that no empirical inquiry can identify two spatio-temporal entities which have different locations, but that knowledge seems too trivial to be relevant. That, you know, two things can't be in the same place at the same time.
So there's an ontological gap between this thing and that thing because they're not in the same place.
Exactly. But he says that seems too trivial to bear on this. He says, what other cases in which we know a priori about natural ontological kinds? The only examples which I can think of are the distinctions between finite and infinite, between human and divine, and between particular and universal. Nothing we intuit could cross those divides. But these examples do not seem very helpful. We are inclined to say that we do not know what it would be for something infinite to exist. If we were to clarify the orthodox notion of the divine, we seem to have either a merely negative conception or else one explicated in terms of the notion of infinity and immateriality. So he goes on, and ultimately he will link up the notion of our mental with bridging the particular and the universal. But yes, Wes, I think that he brings those up because he's just trying to articulate what that is, the ontological gap.
Yeah, so he's trying to see if we have, I guess, other examples in which we know an ontological gap a priori. And he's going to conclude that the infinite and the divine, we have these negative concepts. Well, they're both inconceivable. Let's put it that way.
So are we in the same circumstance with the mental and the physical? We know what the physical is.
Yep.
Is the mental just what's not physical? Is that really all we can say about it?
Right. In the case of the infinite and the divine, really what we have is a sort of negative conception. And it may be the case with the immaterial as well. So on page 20, we feel vaguely confident that if the infinite could exist, it, like the universal, could be exemplified by the immaterial. If it makes any sense to speak of the existence of universals, it would seem that they must exist immaterially, and that is why they can never be identified with spatiotemporal particulars.
So we should explain that for folks that didn't.
Yeah, this is the part of the argument I had trouble figuring out what he's trying to do here. I mean, at the end of this, he's basically going to ask the question of whether the mental and the immaterial are synonyms, whether we can make non-spatiality or immateriality a criterion of the mental. And he's going to say no. But this particular part is less clear to me. Anyone have a good way of explaining it?
Why the existence of universals implies that they must be immaterial?
We at least should spell out, because we haven't talked about universals here before today. So we're talking about, you know, my mind versus mind in general, or even more literally, this particular cat versus catness or something. Unless you're Plato, you probably think that that's just something that we've abstracted. You're a nominalist. It's just an idea that we have that is abstracted from individual things.
Or even the predicate red, even something as simple as that, any property.
And in that way, it's immaterial. It doesn't exist in the world. It's not made of stuff.
Right. It can't be just the case that red is exhausted by this red thing and that red thing and this red thing. There has to be something that makes them all red. What is it? What is it that we are thinking about?
Yep.
You can't just say, well, I think of other red things in the past. But how did you know which of the things in your memory to pick out as red?
What is it that they all have in common that makes them red?
Yes.
Yes.
They have redness. They have the universal. And if folks listen to our De Anima episode, there's an interesting sort of side note here on Aristotle and the nous. And that was sort of the mysterious thing about it. This is, you know, pre-Cartesian type of epistemology is he's claiming the ancient Greeks did not have this mind as a mirror representing the outside world. If we remember, Aristotle actually felt like your eye, when it grasps red, it actually, some part of it turns red. There's like a little fluid in there that turns red. That was more the model of how we interact with the world, is that a little, you know, just like when you smell something, it's because a piece of that thing has gotten in your nose.
It becomes part of you.
Yes, that's the way sight works. And so for us to grasp universals, there must be some special part of us, the nous, the understanding, that can become all things. And this is sort of an early version of what might be the mind, in more Descartes in the more recent sense, is this thing in us that somehow can become the highest mountain. You know, whenever we just think of it, it can be, in some sense, become all these things. And for Aristotle, that went very well. You can see why Christian theologians, you know, picked up on that as well. That would have to be the soul. That would have to be something that doesn't even exist in our head. How could something in our head become the red, become the mountains, become the number four? You know, those concepts exist outside of space and time. And so that part of ourselves, that must be our way of hooking up with the divine in some way. Stephen, I feel like we're neglecting you here. What in this section was pricking your interest? Or
all of that, right? Because he's trying to get us to see how the mind-body distinction was modern philosophy grafting on the universal and the particular. And that once you accept that there's no way to get from the universal, which by definition is immaterial, back to its material particular instantiation in the world, Platonism collapses. And I think what he's leading to is this conclusion that he comes to on page 30 of my edition. I think it sounds like we're on the same pagination. But if you attempt some kind of new form of dualism, insisting that the mental and the physical are ontologically separate from one another, but as soon as there's an ontological gap, we are no longer talking about states or properties, but about distinct particulars, distinct subjects of predication. Neo-dualist who identifies a pain with how it feels to be in pain is hypostatizing a property, painfulness, into a special sort of particular, a particular of that special sort whose esse is percipi and whose reality is exhausted in our initial acquaintance with it. The neo-dualist is no longer talking about how people feel, but about feelings as little self-subsistent entities floating free of people in the way in which universals float free of the instantiations. So you end up with the same problem that you always have when you attempt to understand redness as a relationship to a universal red, as you do when you try to think about pain as something separate from people feeling pain. It becomes free-floating and attaches to experience absolutely nowhere, right? So he has, in fact, says Rorty, modeled pains on universals. It is no wonder then that he can intuit that pains can exist separately from the body. For this intuition is simply the intuition that universals can exist independently of particulars. That special sort of subject of predication whose appearance is its reality, phenomenal pain, turns out to be simply the painfulness of the pain abstracted from the person having the pain. It is, in short, the universal painfulness itself. To put it oxymoronically, mental particulars, unlike mental states of people, turn out to be universals.
And this is why the phenomenal ends up being immaterial.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's immaterial in the same way, because it relies on universals.
Well, initially when Wes brought up immateriality, it was the Kantian formation that it is non-spatial. Why would we think that the mental is the non-spatial, and then what does he think is wrong with that? Sort of as a first step here. You might think that, well, the pain is in my stomach. My stomach hurts, so the pain is in my stomach. But isn't the pain in my brain? So he brings up phantom limb in particular. If I have a pain in my hand, but my hand has already been cut off, so it's not really in my hand. The pain must be in my head. So that's one of the arguments from skepticism, to say that, oh, no, the pain is always in your head. And then, well, where in particular in your head? No, it's just the way we think about pain, the way we think about any of these mental things, according to this picture anyway, is that it's not in any particular space. You know, think of it, if you imagine something, like, well, where is that? It's in my mind's eye. Well, how big is your mind's eye? Like, no, bigness is not something that applies to it. It's a non-spatial thing.
It's interesting that if you walk into a door, the pain is incorrigible. But if you have a phantom pain or a pain in a phantom limb, it's mental, but not incorrigible.
It is actually still incorrigible in the sense that you're not deceived that you're having a pain. What's not incorrigible is whether the belief that the,
it was caused by, yeah, it's cause.
I think the contradiction here is the fact that mental states are, on one intuition, they're immaterial, they're not located anywhere. On the other hand, they are attached to human beings who are in space. That is the problem.
And he's kind of offhand about it. He says, well, Kant and Strassen have given very good arguments that all of these mental facilities have to be owned by a particular person. This is just one of the stylistic things that makes it a little hard to follow him and evaluate him, because he'll throw in things like that. Like, well, what is the argument? Why do they have to be? Because that's what Berkeley, for instance, believed. In fact, this is just what I was getting at with Aristotle, that there's somehow these universals and there's somehow mind in general, God's mind, and really, and we're all just little hunks of God's mind or something like that. And so he's just going to go with, in the history of philosophy, some very smart people have shown that that doesn't really make a lot of sense. That's not a very satisfying, if that was one of your own tendencies to think that, no, the mental is a whole realm. In fact, maybe the mental contains the physical or something.
I think the general gist here is that once we have this contradiction between the seeming non-spatiality of mental states and the fact that they are attached to spatially located persons, then you have to figure out why, you know, you have this spatial entity, a person, and some of their states are mental, and then some of their states are non-mental. So then the question becomes how you distinguish those different types of states. And then that gets us into his discussion of functional states.
There's a quote from page 18 that I wanted to make sure we read just about this dual aspect theory, Spinoza's double aspect theory, that it is tempting for the dualist to go linguistic and begin talking about the different vocabularies or alternative descriptions. This jargon suggests that the dualistic intuition in question is merely one of the differences between ways of talking about the same phenomenon, and thus seems to lead one from something like dualism to something like Spinoza's double aspect theory. But the question, two descriptions of what, makes this a difficult position to hold on to. To reply, two descriptions of organisms seems all right until we ask, are organisms physical? Or is there more to organisms, even human organisms, than the actual and possible dispositions of their parts? It's a similar move to what you were just making in terms of if you say that, oh, somehow all mental states belong to organisms, but what are organisms and how can organisms have some properties that are spatial and some that are not spatial?
One way to get at that is to talk like a functionalist and say that, well, mental states, they're immaterial in the sense that they're the functional states of the organism. So, for instance, if you're talking about pain, instead of talking about pain and these sort of intrinsic qualities that it has, you talk about its causal relations to the organism as a whole. So you could say it's something that tends to produce the belief that there's something wrong. It produces the desire not to have pain. It might cause anxiety. So you put together this whole causal matrix of what pain does and where it comes from. That's your functionalist theory of pain. The problem with that is that there are lots of functionalist states of organisms that are actually not mental, like, for instance, health or fame or beauty, I think he also brings up. So then you're left with the question of what feature then is shared by pains and beliefs that beauty and health doesn't have. So the functional criteria doesn't work here. We still need to say why one thing is mental and one thing is not mental. And that basically, I think, is the gist of this whole, or section one of chapter one, the sustained argument that we can't make non-spatiality a criteria of mental states. It breaks down every time we try to make that work.
Right. He himself gives a good summary of the section on page 31. He says, I've said that the only way to associate the intentional with the immaterial is to identify it with the phenomenal, and that the only way to identify the phenomenal with the immaterial is to hypostatize universals and think of them as particulars rather than abstractions from particulars, thus giving them a non-spatiotemporal habitation. It turns out, in other words, a universal particular distinction is the only metaphysical distinction we've got, the only one which moves anything at all outside of space, much less outside of space-time. The mental-physical distinction, then, is parasitic on the universal-particular distinction rather than conversely.
So that's the summary at the end of section two.
Oh, that's section two?
Yeah. I had just gotten to the end of section one where he...
Whoops. Oh, sorry.
He's just arguing that spatiality can't be a criteria of mental states. And then in section two, he's going to go on to talk about this attempt to define the mental as the intentional or the phenomenal. You know, you read his nice summary there of what he's doing with this section. So
let's make clear that what the intentional is and what the phenomenal is. So we're talking about the feel of something, that is its phenomenal appearance. Whereas intentionality in this sense has to do with directedness. So a lot of people have characterized the mental as its aboutness. It's a perception of something. But, you know, a pain doesn't necessarily seem like it's about something. I mean, you could maybe try to force it into that, like, oh, it's about my stomach that is hurting or something. But that's not really what the contents of the experience of pain is.
We can have an intentional proposition involving pain, like my foot is in pain. But the pain itself is not that. The feeling, the qualia of being in pain is not itself this about thing.
Explain how the proposition is intentional.
Because it's about something. It's directed towards...
Because it's about the state of affairs.
Yes, it's about something in the world. And
yes.
And then, you know, you take beliefs. So that's a belief. And beliefs aren't actually phenomenal. And this is something I think Wittgenstein emphasized. You know, when you have a belief, it's not like a qualia. There's not a feel to it. There are these sort of in-between cases, which you'll get into, of, you know, mental imagery, the paradigm case. But beliefs themselves are not these raw feels. You can have a belief without having any sort of qualitative experience.
So that's one of the questions, like, what is a belief really? I mean, he talks about beliefs that hover before the mind. It could have a qualitative feel. In other words, when you're thinking about that belief, but clearly if we want to explain behavior using beliefs, there are lots of things that we believe all the time that we are not thinking of whenever we're exhibiting behaviors that show that we believe it. So in other words, the beliefs are not conscious. They're not part of our qualia, but yet we talk about them as mental.
Even conscious beliefs are not. So if we sit together and have a conversation and we rattle on sentence after sentence after sentence, in many cases, there's not even mental imagery associated with those sentences and the beliefs involved. It's completely non-imagistic. Do you see what I'm saying?
So does having a phenomenal feel and being imagistic, are those the same thing?
So he'll go on to say in this section that there's some hybrid cases, like you mentioned, having the words. If you take your belief and you focus on the words, or if you actually do focus on mental imagery, you concentrate on something you're saying and some sort of imagery associated with it. Yes, any sort of mental imagery. So mental imagery is a case where the phenomenal and the intentional seem to be combined. So we start out in this section, we distinguish the phenomenal from the intentional. Those are two different things. So then why are they put together in this category of the mental? Well, we might look at the possibility family resemblances. So we can find this sort of overlapping case of mental imagery, which is both phenomenal and intentional. And beliefs look like mental imagery in their intentionality. And then our qualia look like mental imagery in their phenomenality. So we lump them all together. That's one theory of why they might have gotten lumped together.
Or is it just because they're both not physical?
Well, then the question is, you know, well, we've said what the mental is now in terms of the phenomenal and the intentional. And then, so what do we mean by the physical? Is it just derivative? Is it just the non-mental? Why would we want to say the intentional is non-material? And why would we want to say the phenomenal is non-material? So the rest of what he does in this section is to say why we might think those things.
Which ends up being rooted in what Stephen read about linking up between the universal particular distinction.
Well, in the case of the intentional being non-material, our intuition there is that you can look at someone's brain, but that doesn't reveal any intentionality, right? You can't just look at the brain matter and see anything that's intentional in there. And his sort of analogy there is in the same way, when you look at a sentence on a page, if you're reading, there's no intentionality to the typographical properties of those letters. The intentionality only comes when you have a language user who understands the language and can interpret those typographical properties. In other words, there's no semantics inherent in the typography. The semantics has to be provided by the language user. So that will make us think that intentional properties are not physical properties. That's why we want to separate those two things.
And he gives an example, it's later on in the book, but of walking through a giant brain where you could actually watch all of the neurons firing and stuff. And even if you could link up a particular mode in which those neurons were firing, and you could say that, oh, that's this brain thinking about a car, just seeing them happening, that would not be the same thing as seeing the thought.
Right. It totally depends on your familiarity with the system.
Yeah. You have to interpret it.
Yeah. So he says, if you are a particle physicist and you're really used to, you know, looking at complex readouts from your fancy machines, then you're seeing the atoms, or you're seeing the physical behavior in a way that somebody who's not a physicist and doesn't even know how to put the example in the correct words, like I don't, is not seeing those things.
There was a great example of this for me just tonight. I was watching this PBS show about the history of recorded music, and the section was on the development of multi-track recording and how that led. And the example they gave, and they attributed it to being the first example, was of the Beatles with George Martin recording a Revolver and beginning to have music that was literally unperformable, that the studio activity itself was part of the creation of the music as another performer. And the reason I thought about this book and this particular image was you had all these musicians who described, I heard this album and I, the first time on the radio, and I pulled off to the side of the road and I was just talking with the other guys and we were just blown away. They immediately recognized on hearing it that something that A, hadn't been done before. They were hearing something utterly new. And they also, on the one hand, recognized it as utterly new, were confused by it, but knew enough about it to be completely blown away and inspired by it. Whereas they went through the song that John Lennon did, Tomorrow Never Knows or something.
Tomorrow Never Knows.
And yeah. You know, there's all these wild sounds in that song. I had no idea that they were completely made up, sliced up tapes backwards and stuff like that.
You thought they got seagulls in the studio to go, wah, 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 wah.
Exactly. I mean, I felt very naive about the whole thing. But what was amazing to me about this is just the whole idea of context, that being able to recognize it and the fact that you're so impressed and blown away by it relies on a ton of your own context. And it was just an example of it.
If you're walking through Leibniz's brain that's been blown up to the size of a factory, do you really ever cross the syntactical, semantical divide, no matter how well trained you are to read neuronal firing and have it correspond to car or red or my wallet was left in Vienna?
Right. I agree.
It doesn't seem like you ever would.
But why does that not count as an ontological gap?
Exactly.
I mean, do you feel like in grafting that to a universal particular divide? And he's sort of saying in the history of philosophy, there was this kind of fuck up where people started trying to think about what a pain is as opposed to what it is to have a pain. And that made it go down this universal particular rabbit hole, and pain became immaterial and therefore non-spatial and therefore quasi ghost in the machine. I still say you're at an ontological gap.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't bridge semantical and syntactical when you're inside Leibniz's brain.
Right. He seems to suggest that it's sort of like knowing the language. Like, suppose you could read people's brain states as fluently as you could read English. He says something like that the brain inscriptions, in a way, are no more mysterious than inscriptions in a text. But the difference is if you can read the brain, that doesn't mean you have the experiences associated with the brain. You can see that someone is having such and such a thought or such and such a feeling, but that doesn't mean you would have the thought or have the feeling. So that's one problem. And the other is you as an observer, you come to that situation with your semantics, with your dictionary. But the brain doesn't have that luxury. There's no built-in dictionary. It has to produce meaning purely out of syntax.
The brain in producing experience isn't really, really good at reading syntax and translating it into semantics. It's just semantical.
Okay, so I mean, strictly speaking, if we think about the brain as a biological entity, it's just a syntactic system, you know, in the same way we might think of a computer as a syntactic system. It's just a set of rules and processes and, you know, one neuronal connection affects another. In order for that to actually be a language, we need a semantics, but the reader can bring his semantics to the text, but the brain can't supply itself with the semantics unless you think that syntax can somehow be so robust that semantics sort of emerges out of it. So you can call the mind-body problem the semantics-syntax problem. It's not clear how any syntactical system can generate its own semantics. That's really another way of restating the mind-body problem.
The brain doesn't produce experience because it's adept at reading its own neuronal patterns, right?
Right.
It thinks because it has those neuronal patterns.
Well, isn't it thinking those neuronal patterns? It's not like the thinking happens in consequence of the neuronal patterns.
Right. But that's my point, is that it's not that the person walking through your brain, which is now blown up to the size of the factory, would be able to think your thoughts. If you think that they can think your thoughts by being able to read your neuronal patterns well, The other absurdity is then thinking that you were able to read them in the first place because you read your own neuronal patterns well. And that's not what thinking is. And that's not the relationship between consciousness and the firing of neurons.
Yeah. I just want to say, I don't think that Rorty is saying that you should be able to walk through a giant brain blown up to the size of a factory and read off those thoughts. I think, in fact, he uses that specific example to demonstrate that that's not possible.
Let me read the quote. It's page 26. Why should we be troubled by Leibniz's point that if the brain were blown up to the size of a factory so that we could stroll through it, we should not see thoughts? If we knew enough neural correlations, we shall indeed see thoughts, in the sense that our vision will reveal to us what thoughts the possessor of the brain is having. If we do not, we shall not, but then if we stroll through any factory without having first learned about its parts and their relations to one another, we shall not see what is going on.
Yes, so you have to have the semantics in order to understand it.
Right, so he's saying that you can read the thoughts but not have the experience. But exactly. He's also saying that the difference between being able to read the thoughts and having the experience is not itself the ontological gap, but he doesn't really tell you why.
Right.
We're talking about Searle's Chinese room argument, which we don't need to re-explain in Searle's terms, but this is
right.
The context between the semantics and the syntax is exactly what Wes was just saying. Searle's take on this is that first-person access is an epistemological thing, but it's not an ontological thing. So my thoughts are epistemologically subjective. You can't take my point of view somehow and see them that way, but they're ontologically objective, that they are things in the brain, and that's just, there's only one ontological category, but epistemologically, we get at them two different ways. Does that solve the problem? I'm not sure I understand. I think Rorty would be mystified by that response. Would say, instead of insisting that there is no ontological gap, that it's merely an epistemological gap, why don't you just stop talking about ontology altogether?
Hmm. Well, he would be in favor of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not trying to argue that we should have a different ontology. It's sort of part and parcel to saying that there isn't an ontological gap is in the end that the ontological categories end up not doing the work that we want them to. In that way, he's anti-metaphysical.
Yep.
The whole point of this section is, or this paragraph, he's saying that our intuition about saying, well, the intentional is non-material because intentional properties are not physical properties, he's going to say yes, but they're just non-material in the same sense that any functional state is non-material. That's really the point of all this. So in the same way that health and beauty are non-material, which is another way of saying that it's not evident to everyone who looks at it, that it's this kind of relationship to the parts, like health being a relationship to the parts of the body, that if we knew how to read that inscription, if we knew all those relationships, then it would be evident and we wouldn't be so inclined to think of it as non-material, something like that. But go ahead, Stephen, sorry.
All right, it's time once again to stop and talk about our sponsor. Seth, come back from the netherworld to speak to us about this. I don't know if it's me, maybe the election, but it seems like there are a lot of folks that are feeling a little down lately.
That is true.
And that's why I'm excited to introduce our sponsor this week, Talkspace.
Now, if you've ever thought about doing therapy, and if you listen to this podcast, you probably have. But, you know, it's expensive, it's inconvenient, it's hard to work schedules out, or maybe you just don't want to get face-to-face with somebody because it's too embarrassing to get into an office and sit in a waiting room with a bunch of people you don't know. You might give Talkspace a try. Talkspace is an online therapy company, and they make it easy to connect with a licensed therapist who's handpicked just for you for as little as $32 a week. Using Talkspace, you can text, audio, and video message the therapist as much as you want. The therapist can listen to you talk about work or family, relationships, and hopefully put you on the path to a happier life. To sign up or to learn more, go to Talkspace.com/examined. And if, as a special offer to you guys, if you use the coupon code examined, you will get $30 off your first month. Talkspace, therapy for how we live today.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute. St. John's is founded really on one of the simplest, oldest activities that human beings have ever done, and that is conversation.
There's no props, no pretense. It's just folks sitting around talking about a book.
They have an Eastern Classics program, the traditions of India, China, and Japan, and they do the Western Classics.
St. John's College has two campuses, one in Santa Fe and one in Annapolis.
So I taught at the Annapolis campus in the undergraduate program mainly. But both campuses have graduate programs.
One of the things that differentiates St. John's was that they're really interested in getting people engaged with issues and questions that are raised by the text. It's not really vocational or professional training, and that's a good thing.
Yes, and it ends up being more transformational of the individual student and their engagement both with their intellectual life and their engagement with the world.
Yeah, what we're doing with Partially Examined Life validates that, because for the last 8 years that we've been recording this podcast and engaging with text and issues and questions, I myself have been transformed. And so I can highly recommend this as an approach to education. Now, if you're a PEL citizen, a fan, or even a casual listener, and you would like to get together with folks just like you in a more formal and intimate setting to explore these great texts, to explore great questions, to feed your mind and your soul, you should check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, you can visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
All right, well, let's get back to the discussion.
There's just a quote later on, page 66. He says, "Since a man's build, personality, weight, hilarity, or charm is not capable of being pinpointed in space, why should his beliefs and desires be?"
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. So being non-spatial in that sense is just not that mysterious. It does not call for a different ontological category.
Yeah.
That's the root of why he's arguing that there isn't an ontological gap. It ought not be any more confusing. And there's no more need for a presence of an ontological gap than there is for those other things that we just normally don't have a problem with. The non-locality of one's fame.
So there is a gap. There are different types of explanations, but it's not an ontological gap.
We're not there yet.
Okay.
We have to talk about the phenomenal and the, you know, so after he tries to convince us that, yes, the intentional is non-material, but not in the philosophically pregnant sense, right? Just in the functional sense. Then we need something else, and he gives us Locke. You know, we need another reason if we're going to think that the intentional is non-material. And in the case of Locke, there is another reason to think that. Meaningfulness depends on it. So whereas for Wittgenstein, meaning is use, let's say, or the way something fits into a larger context, for Locke, there has to be this phenomenal element for us to have a belief, what Locke calls an idea. The meaningfulness of a belief has to be explained in terms of something that is phenomenal, and so it derivatively borrows its immateriality from the phenomenal. That's another way to put it. And so that's the segue into the question of whether the phenomenal is immaterial. So we have to knock that down now.
So even all the unconscious beliefs, you know, we've got innumerable numbers just walking down the street and the fact that I don't think my foot is going to fall through the ground. Well, okay, that's sort of a belief I had, but those either have to somehow, for Locke, have to be derivable from some actual thoughts that we have had at some point. You know, something, we started out tabula rasa and we learned these things. So of course, you know, we've got all these latent beliefs, but those things either are something that we actually thought were an current belief before and that is now passive, or you could say it's something that is logically deduced from one of those current beliefs that we had, etc. It all comes down to, and you know, having an actual idea with a phenomenal feel in your head as a starting point.
Yeah, another way of saying that we get our semantics for our beliefs, they're provided by what Locke calls ideas, and ideals are these phenomenal things. Ideas are phenomena, and they have a meaning-conferring role in intentionality and belief. So you'll recall when we did the Wittgenstein episode, there is something intuitive about Locke's view, and getting to this idea that meaning is use or embeddedness in a form of life or in some context is actually counterintuitive, where we tend to think intuitively that meaningfulness depends upon sort of this connection of words to images, let's say, or even a rule, even some hard and fast necessary and sufficient conditions, you know, a definition, something like that. Which for Wittgenstein, that's not the case. So then the question is why, you know, why would we think the phenomenal is immaterial? because we can know all the physical properties of something without knowing what it feels, if it's something that does have feelings. It's kind of similar to the intentionality case. But in this case, Mark, he brings up what you brought up about an epistemic versus an ontological gap. Why do we make a move from what we can know about things to what they really are? Our knowing all the physical properties doesn't allow us to get at the feeling. Why does that mean there's this ontological gap? And the answer to that is that we have to say that the feelings themselves, that their only reality is being an appearance, because then once we've done that, the epistemic collapses into the ontological. That's why he gets into this idea of the reality of feelings being exhausted by their being appearances, by their being pure seemings. That's the only way for us to justify the epistemic gap leading to an ontological gap.
Which, of course, is just to bring up Searle again, folks that listened to our interview with him, he's arguing against the exact same picture from Descartes and Locke that Rorty is. You know, that all we ever know is appearances. And Searle just straightforwardly says, no, we actually know the stuff. We don't have a Cartesian theater. We don't have an inner eye that beholds these appearances that then we know thoroughly and indubitably, but it's always a question of whether they actually correspond to what's outside. No, we're just in touch with the stuff that's outside. So Rorty in this is not so straightforward as he's much more careful and circumspect than John Searle was in our interview with him. But it's a hypothesis of mine that they're kind of coming down to the same thing, that, you know, I wouldn't venture that Searle actually read this book. I don't know.
I'm not so sure, actually. I don't think so.
No? Okay.
Because Searle, I don't think, is actually very much different than the people he thinks he's criticizing. He still has a mediated view of knowledge, but that's another. But yeah, so the next step here, I mean, we've gotten to these pure seemings, and this is where you get the collapse into substance dualism, because if feelings, reality feelings, is exhausted by there being appearances, then, you know, something like a pain is no longer a property, but it's actually a kind of particular. It's this mind stuff that you get in substance dualism or Cartesian dualism. So essentially, you know, this identification of the reality of a phenomenal thing with its appearance ends up being a hypostatization of a property. So you get this feelings as self-subsistent, free-floating entities, and then this idea that they are in fact modeled on universals, that mental particulars are universals, as Stephen mentioned.
So let's get a little clearer on that last step. I get the idea. Look, it's the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. It's hypostatization, as you just said, or reification is another thing. To say my perceiving something as red is perceiving a red something. And I'm not talking about the thing out in the world, but a red perception, that the perception becomes thingified, or the feeling of pain becomes thingified. So, but that's still an individual. So again, why make the last step towards saying this individual pain is somehow my connectivity to the general notion of pain, to a universal? Why say universals are involved in there at all?
Well, first of all, I think we should say, why is it that once we say something, that the reality of feelings are exhausted by there being appearances, that we've hypostatized them? To avoid hypostatizing them, you have to say that these things are properties. He thinks that saying they're properties of sentient beings is not compatible with their reality being exhausted by the way they feel. I've forgotten how he makes that step, so maybe there's a quotation there.
Yeah, if you focus on just the redness of something, I don't know what that thing is, but I know that it's red. So, okay, I'm sure that it seems red to me. Why does that make redness into a thing? Why does that, even that individual redness, not redness in general, but that instance of redness, why do it? No, I'm saying it's a red object I'm looking at. It's just that I'm not saying anything else about the object other than that it is red. I'm not hypostatizing at all.
Well, Mark, are you asking that question in criticism of Rorty? Or you're wondering what Rorty is saying? Because I think that that move of hypostatizing red happens all the time, and that's Platonic forms, right? And it seems to me he is saying something like asking that question exactly in the way you're asking it, which is, that's not necessary. That kind of thingness of those universals is unnecessary.
I was just going to read the quote, because he thinks this hypostasization is not some arbitrary thing. It follows on the idea that feelings just are appearances. So reading at the bottom of page 29, first of all, in the previous paragraph, why should this epistemic distinction reflect an ontological distinction? And then the beginning of the last paragraph on 29. The answer presumably has to go something like this. Feelings just are appearances. Their reality is exhausted in how they seem. They are pure seemings. Anything that is not a seeming, putting the intentional to one side for the moment, is merely physical. That is, it is something which can appear other than it is. So this goes back to the incorrigibility thing. The world comes divided into things whose nature is exhausted by how they appear and things whose nature is not. But if a philosopher gives this answer, he is in danger of changing from a neo-dualist into a plain old-fashioned Cartesian dualist, mind, stuff, and all. For now, he stopped talking about pains as states of people or properties predicated of people and started talking about pains as particulars, a special sort of particular whose nature is exhausted by a single property. So in other words, to say, yeah, well, I can't say it better than that. Of what could such particular be made, save mind stuff? Or to put it another way, what could mind stuff be, save something out of which such thin, wispy, and translucent things can be made? And so on. So,
yeah, so as long as feeling painful is a property of a person or of brain fibers, there seems no reason for the epistemic difference between reports of how things feel and reports of anything else to produce an ontological gap. But as soon as there is an ontological gap, we are no longer talking about states or properties, but about distinct particulars, distinct subjects of predication. This is in that. The neo-dualist who identifies a pain with how it feels to be in pain is hypostasizing a property, painfulness, into a special sort of particular, a particular of that special sort whose esse is percepe and whose reality is exhausted in our initial acquaintance with it. Now we've gone back to a quote that we read before.
So yeah, he's saying that there's kind of this dialectic, this inevitable progression, sort of once you buy into one thing, then not that it will logically entail, right? The fact that conceiving feelings as appearances does not logically entail they are thingified. But as a matter of when you actually try to hold that belief, you will find that you also thingify it.
Yeah.
That sounds like what the dialectic is, according, you know, by Hegel's logic, these things that carry you forward. All right, so where are we? We should kind of get toward wrapping up. We should get the last couple points out there. Have we exposed the faulty reasoning here, the faulty progression in sentiment, in image? Are you convinced? He tries to make it so that any of the standard, you know, if you're trying to ask, well, what is his actual view? Is he a behaviorist? Is he a... He seems to think that all these traditional views, like mind-brain identity theory, it sure sounds like that is what he is. But he says no. And this is, again, something that Searle said just about verbatim when we talked to him, that once you put it that way, you've admitted that there's an ontological gap that needs to be bridged. So sort of going back to the introduction, he's talking about how great Wittgenstein and Heidegger and Dewey were against this Cartesian, Lockean picture we talked about. These people set aside epistemology and metaphysics as possible disciplines. I say set aside rather than argue against, because their attitude towards the traditional problematic is like the attitude of the 17th century philosophers toward the scholastic problematic. They glimpse the possibility of a form of intellectual life in which the vocabulary of philosophical reflection inherited from 17th century would seem as pointless as the 13th century philosophical vocabulary had seemed to the Enlightenment. They're trying to come up with new maps of the terrain, is the whole panorama of human activities, which simply do not include those features which previously seemed to dominate. So that's just, I'm pointing those out because, yeah, he's not really giving us, as he said, I'm not going to give you my theory of the philosophy of mind, because I think the whole idea of a philosophy of mind only results from this faulty picture that we have in the first place. So what judges the choice between pictures? Well, it seems like, and this is, we're getting finally back around to, is he a relativist? We can finally understand. We raised that right at the beginning of the podcast, but it wasn't clear to listeners who weren't familiar with this what that could possibly mean. Well, this is what it means, is if it's just a matter of contingent historical fact that we have these images that give rise to all these problems, can we just pick different ones? Will people with different histories have different conceptual schemes, different philosophical problems. And in fact, chapter two is largely a thought experiment about the antipodeans, which are people that actually do. They don't say, I have a pain. They say, hey, my C fibers are firing. They actually talk about their neural states, not that they have like eyes that point into their brains and can report on it that way. But somehow they simply don't feel the need to express anything in phenomenal terms. And they can't understand when you try to explain to them. Like, they still say, oh yeah, pains are bad. And they run from pains. They say all the same stuff, except they don't use this language. And he seems to think that this is a conceivable way to be, that these fundamental, we think, ways that we understand ourselves or our environments are actually just a matter of historical contingency.
Yes, that sounds not right to me. He calls this a therapeutic exercise, and I need more therapy before I can be dislodged from my conceptual scheme.
I'll give you a reason why I think it sounds right to me, which is that we inherit it enough to feel a kind of mental pain that we can't work out a picture, a satisfying picture of the relationship between ontological objectivity and ontological subjectivity, or, you know, what it is to be a bat or a Steven versus what it is to be a positron or a doorknob. But why, prior to the 17th century, did no one think that raw feels was this huge problem that needed to be accounted for? Why did people not feel as though access to truth was impeded if you couldn't account for qualia? So in some sense, it has to be an historical contingency that certain problems suddenly become urgent.
Yeah.
Right? And surely that must have been the rise of empirical science in the 17th century. You never had anything like empirical reality as science understood it prior to the 17th century. So you never had a problem of the mind, right? Because you never had to try to fit human mentality into something like an objective world, because you'd never taken all of nature and tried to make it law obedient or predictive in that way. So the mind was never this left out thing. So you had to come up with a theory of the mind. The question then is, well, how determinative is historical contingency, and why is Richard Rorty in 1979 able suddenly to make a 200 or 300 year habit of speaking seem irrelevant? By his own theory, it can't be the power of his arguments, right? The engine of obsolescence isn't dialectic, according to his own theory. So why is the book relevant? Is it that we have built hard drives and started to map or come up with probabilistic theories of the quanta, therefore empirical reality is kind of collapsing, therefore we don't need this 17th century concept of the mind as an interior theater? I can't say I have an answer to any of these questions, but you do sort of feel as though he's argued you out of it, but he's also argued you out of the belief that he could argue you out of it.
Just to comment on the historical piece of why this wasn't available before Descartes, there are a bunch of footnotes that do acknowledge the disagreement among cultural historians. So, for instance, he says that he's quoting somebody, the picture of human beings having both an inside and an outside is so commonplace, so as it may seem to us, commonsensical, that we find it hard to realize how strikingly modern it is. But to appreciate its modernity, one need only cast about for statements of it earlier than Descartes. One does find interesting anticipations of it in Augustine, but not much earlier, and not much between the time of Augustine and that of Descartes. This is page 50 to 51. There's like this just massive footnotes. Footnotes are like taking up half the page at some of these places. Like, well, maybe some of this was in Plato, but then it definitely wasn't in Aristotle. And so Aquinas was picking up on the threads from Aristotle, whereas Augustine was picking up on the threads from Plato. You know, so of course it's not that Descartes just invented this.
Right. And also you could say, what else happens in the 17th century, right? Is it the rise of capitalism? Is it the rise of the printing press? Is it the rise of Protestantism, Protestant individualism? I mean, there are all kinds of theories. Does any one of them support a meta theory of causality that allows you to say, because you get X, you therefore get theories of Y? It's unclear to me how different historically contingent theories of the rise of forms of knowledge is different from Kantian theories of the necessary preconditions for knowledge. I mean, why is one a satisfying explanation for why modes of thought arise at periods of history and the other isn't?
Yeah, I was thinking of like, you know, Nietzsche's take on we only became these complex animals because of religion, because of Christianity's self-inward turn. Absolutely had Augustine in mind here, of the need to thingify parts of your, some of your urges, the stain upon your soul, other these elements of your consciousness to create this inner landscape for yourself. Or I'm sure you could see something comparable in the East of the veil of Maya and just these religious coming out of the Vedic tradition through Buddhism. It ended up with something very similar to what Descartes has, is that no, we have the reality, which is unknowable, closer to what Kant has, I guess. And then we've got the phenomena, we've got the appearances. And, you know, at least in some parts of Buddhism, I know, are very psychological, that these appearances are part of the ego and that need to be treated with a certain amount of contempt or put on hold.
He does have this theory of therapy and philosophy as therapy. Mm-hmm. He has this idea that if you just hear a story in one way, that the work of therapy doesn't happen, right? If the therapist on the first visit says, you're terrified that your father's going to castrate you and you want to sleep with your mother, it has zero therapeutic value, even though it may have total truth value. So there's something about telling the story in the right way, over the right period of time, under the right circumstances, that allows you to liberate yourself from it, that you wouldn't need the glassy essence or the mirror to nature if you go back and retell the history of philosophy to yourself properly.
Yes, he thinks this historicization and putting things in historical context is the key to getting a therapeutic effect. So at the point where he's talking about that, Stephen, then he says it's not enough to know that we're in error. We have to know why. We have to give this account of why.
But why do those why accounts have therapeutic power? That's where I get stuck. It's like, that's a truth claim, right? That a certain kind of historically contingent why, like this happened in history, therefore we believe X, right, has the ability to allow you to transcend the need to repeat that story semi-consciously over and over again. But other kinds of knowledge accounts are inherently inadequate or false.
That therapy seems to rely on the state of things for a philosopher now, right? So in some ways, it's a therapy for an analytical philosopher. He points to a commonality with Dewey and Nietzsche and Heidegger in that they all end up at a place that they didn't start with. And I think you would argue a kind of therapy for their previous philosophical lives. It's not clear to me, but I guess I would think that he would say, well, you could have ended up here, ended up at the same place through a different path and not needing the same kind of therapy. And in some ways, he alludes to this, that you could have the disposition, the philosophical mindset of some kind of pre-Cartesian that wouldn't worry about this kind of problem. And so therefore, you wouldn't need the therapy to get yourself out of it. And then his therapy ends up being a kind of meta-philosophy isn't the right way. He admits that it's parasitic upon the whole past. And it does prompt the question to me that at least to the extent that it works, it requires a kind of intellectual path that you've taken, that you won't understand the therapy unless you somehow are part of that whole culture and path already.
I was trying to think of a good example of this therapeutic approach, which is really the genealogical approach. So I'm thinking again of Nietzsche and the genealogy of morals. So what's therapeutic about knowing, for instance, that your beliefs about good and evil really amount to a kind of nihilism and resentiment? If you can illustrate a genealogy where I wouldn't have these beliefs except for the fact that there are these other forces at work, which in a way are in conflict with their manifest content, it has that deflationary effect.
Yeah, well, but that's exactly why that activity is highlighting the contradiction in the content. By going through that genealogy, Nietzsche exposes the internal contradictions and also the fact that the claims being made are not doing the work that they claim to be doing. The very things you thought were not nihilistic are nihilistic, right? That the very things that we thought were leading to a foundation for your living are just rooted in resentment.
Right. I mean, well, one thought is that the work of therapy isn't completed when you have the right picture in your head. It's not a spectatorial or relationship to truth. It's an experiential relationship with a therapist that may never result in you acknowledging the Oedipus complex or being even especially conscious of it. It's that you've lived it again with the therapist and become healthy. And healthy may not, it may not have a pictorial or a kind of inner representation. You may not be able to say the words, I wanted to sleep with my mother, I wanted to kill my father, I was afraid my dad was going to castrate me. And yet you may have achieved health in some way.
Why is it a therapy rather than an exercise or any other kind of activity that you're doing? When you call it a therapy, it means that it's, and just the way you described, Stephen, a kind of constant working out that may not even result in the goal that the therapy is oriented to, right? For instance, it's not curative.
Well, maybe he means therapy more generally, like physical therapy, not like psychotherapy necessarily.
Well, but even physical therapy is the same kind of thing. Physical therapy is distinct. I would say it's distinct from exercise. Physical therapy is activity aimed at either correcting a malfunction or providing enough support so that that malfunction doesn't recur. It's different than an activity directed at flourishing.
And also, if you think about it, I mean, this book, I love this book. I think it's a masterpiece, but it is sort of bad therapy, right? I mean, he's beginning with the premise that you don't need to do it at all. He clearly has to do it. He has to do it obsessively. He has to relive the era of 300 years of philosophy in order to rid himself of it. But then ultimately for him, it was successful, right? He did get rid of it. He never really revisited these problems in this way.
And just to come full circle, I'm trying to picture this guy with his interpersonal skills, as we've described, being your therapist. Like, what a jerk. What a bad therapist. Yeah, I think he thinks that philosophers have an unhealthy obsession with these particular problems. And the cyclical, feudal thinking, I can definitely see where he's going in using that metaphor.
Sounds like a closing.
Like the problem of other minds he brings up in chapter two, just that, you know, yeah, this is something that is sort of, it's a theoretical possibility that nobody else has a mind besides you, or that these particular individuals are just robots or zombies or something like that. But you shouldn't respond to that worry by saying, no, by definition, that, you know, so he says Kant and the logical empiricists both sort of made it by definition that didn't even make sense. No, it's a real problem, but it's not a problematic problem. It's not anything you should actually worry about.
It's a problem you can choose not to have.
It's based on a legitimate observation, but the observation does not make it a problem by itself. You do that.
Stop being that. Curious. Sorry.
Prove to me that you're a person who said that, Wes. Prove to me. I'm so curious. I think that we did enough for today. We got a taste, and we'll get some more later after we... So next time, we're actually going to take a little diversion, because we found when we got into the next chapters of this that he said... Yeah, I'm channeling Quine and Wittgenstein and Wilfred Sellers. And Wilfred Sellers we had not done yet. So we're reading his article, Empiricism and the Philosophy of Mind. And then we will come back to some more Rorty. And I don't want to put you on the spot, Stephen, but if you want to go through more of this, you're certainly welcome.
You continuing on in Mirror?
Yes. That's the chapters 3 and 4.
Fantastic. Tell me when and where. No, I'd love it. What's better than bad therapy?
When and where? It's non-spatial. That's where it is.
But is it universal?
It's not even temporal. It's eternal. All right, guys. Thanks so much to everybody for listening to this.
Thanks, yeah. Stephen. It was great having you on.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks a lot, guys. It was really, really fun.
Folks should chime in. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. Make a comment on the blog about this episode. Go to our Facebook page. You can like that. You can follow us on Twitter. You can support us with your monies and all that kind of stuff.
Support for the Partially Examined Life comes from Talkspace, the online therapy company that believes that therapy should be affordable, confidential, and convenient. Join over 500,000 people who have used Talkspace for online therapy with their licensed therapist. For a special offer, visit Talkspace.com/examined. Again, that's talkspace.com/examined.
And just to make a comment about our closing song, this is again a creation by one of the folks that I interviewed for the Nakedly Examined Music podcast. That's nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. The episode was number 9 with Roderick Romero. You're about to hear his Seattle psychedelic 90s band Sky Cries Mary. They actually have an album called A Return to the Inner Experience, so I thought that was very fitting for this episode. But this song is from the following album, 1994's This Timeless Turning. The song is called The Wall of Nothingness. So it is sort of like when you return to the inner experience, to the flux, the primordial qualia, you find that it's fundamentally inexpressible. So you hear this song, though it has vocalizations, does not have words until very far into the song, and even then, not many of them. More just commenting on the lack of features on the wall of nothingness. So please go check out my interview with Roderick, nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. That's episode number 9. And I want to remind you about the wall calendar. Go take a look at partiallyexaminedlife.com/calendar, or else perhaps you will have a wall of nothingness. Thanks and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.